I'm Elizabeth Cruikshank. I started as a teacher, became a solicitor, and eventually for 10 years I edited a magazine for women solicitors, which is why I've become so fascinated by the history and the of women in the law. And particularly in one solicitor, Carrie Morrison. At the beginning of December 1922, I better tell you as well, I'm a bit hoarse tonight, so you may find that we switch horses in the middle of the stream and my husband will take over. That's why he's drinking apple juice. At the beginning of December 1922, there were four women who passed the finals examinations of the Law Society of England and Wales. Maud Crofts and Mary Sykes were daughters of lawyers, and Mary Pickup was married to one. But there was very little information available about the fourth woman, Carrie Morrison, her life, why she chose to become a solicitor, and why she was admitted as the first woman solicitor of the Supreme Court of England and Wales. Well, about 10 years ago, I embarked on what I thought was going to be a little project to find out as much as I could about her life. I thought, well, it would take me about a year at most, and it might result in an article for the Law Society Gazette. But her background was much stranger and her achievements much more substantial than I had imagined. Her early life was very different from those of the other three women, who you might say came from relatively stolid middle-class backgrounds. She was born on the 3rd of February, 1888, in Richmond. Her birth certificate showed that her father was Thomas Morrison and her mother was Judith Wakefield Shepherd. Because of her Wakefield middle name, I discovered relatively quickly that her mother was born in 1836, the third of five daughters of Thomas Shepherd, who was an illiterate Nottinghamshire labourer. In the 1881 census, she had risen, if you like, to become the cook for the rector of Middleton Cheney in Oxfordshire. Carrie's father was quite another matter. The 1891 census told me that Thomas and Judith Morrison were living at 1 Lichfield Gardens, Richmond, with their 3-year-old Carrie and her 1-year-old sister, Maggie. Thomas Morrison was described as a Spanish merchant, whatever that was, born in Scotland, aged 56, and therefore 21 years older than Judith. They had 3 domestic servants, including a nurse for the girls. And that was it. That was all I could find. After spending hours searching Scotland's people for a man called Thomas Morrison, a very common name north of the border, I decided to just forget about that and turn to Carrie's early life. But eventually I did discover who Thomas Morrison was, thanks to the archivist of Manchester High School for Girls, and a retired radiologist who lives in Melbourne, Australia. Thomas Morrison, it turned out, was born in 1834. He was the son of James Morrison, an innkeeper in the small Scottish village of Auchterarder, of golfing fame. After leaving Scotland, probably in his early 20s, he acquired substantial wealth through trading in copper in the City of London Metal Exchange. In fact, he was very well regarded there, and he was one of the very early members of the London Metal Exchange. His brother James was employed by the Spanish arm of a Scottish mining company, Darcis Sulphur and Copper. And it was probably through him that Thomas Morrison became involved in the manufacture and supply of copper goods. hence Spanish merchant. Carey's early years were extremely peripatetic, as Thomas Morrison moved his small family many times to France and to various locations in Spain, and in between times, returning to England. By the age of 12, Carey had spent only about 2.5 years in formal schooling, and that had been conducted in 3 different countries and in 3 different languages. In 1900, when Carey was 12, her father, realizing that he was very ill, reorganized his business interests to ensure his family's financial security, and he took his family on a 12-week round-the-world trip, incorporating Australia, Hawaii, Vancouver, and New York. Carey described part of this journey in an article for a Manchester High School for Girls magazine, showing remarkably acute observation skills. Her father died in 1901, soon after they returned, at a small village north of Barcelona called El Masnou. Later that year, Judith Morrison, for some reason which I have not been able to discover, took her 2 young daughters to Hanover in Germany, where they lived for 3 years, and where Carey picked up almost native German. But in 1904, they returned to England, but not to Richmond, not to Nottinghamshire, where her family still lived, but to Buxton in Derbyshire, where she managed a large boarding house in an elegant part of town. And a neat little similarity with Helena, I think. Carey and her younger sister Maggie attended Manchester High School for Girls, and I have not been able to discover whether they boarded or whether they took the train every morning from Buxton to Manchester, which was definitely possible, and I believe on time. But by this time, Carey could speak English, French, Spanish, German, and Catalan, and had a commendable capacity for hard work. Both her school and Girton College, Cambridge, awarded her exhibitions amounting to £45 per annum in total. She participated fully in school and university life, playing hockey, swimming, debating, and writing. And in 1910, she left Girton College, Cambridge, with the equivalent of first-class honours in medieval and modern languages. And you probably all know that she couldn't have a degree from Cambridge because they didn't award them formally to women until 1948. So she has left university and she needs a job. Because of the shortage of occupational opportunities for university-educated women at that time, a great many entered teaching, including Carey. Indeed, 24 out of her year at Girton of 44 did exactly the same. Carey taught modern languages first in Penarth, South Wales, then in Putney, and finally in 1914 at Streatham Hill High School, where she also learned shorthand and typing because she wanted to become a political secretary. She later confessed that she hated teaching, and that was bad for the children I had to teach. Her political secretarial ambitions, however, were thwarted by the First World War, which she spent in a variety of governmental occupations, mostly, and strangely, under the umbrella of MI5. She was the first to work for them in their military permit office, a position which was to lead indirectly to the solicitor's profession. There she met Alfred Baker, a West End solicitor, who considered that she'd been particularly helpful when he was applying for permits to allow his staff to travel to wartime Europe. He was so impressed that he offered her an administrative position in his office after the war was over. This would have been about 1915. He offered her an administrative position in his office. Yes, sorry, I'm repeating that. She wasn't able to take up his offer immediately at the end of the war, as she was seconded to Constantinople to work for the Army of the Black Sea. An interesting move, that, from the centre of London to the capital of a recently defeated and unsettled country where Britain and France were vying for trading rights and influence. What was she doing there? I haven't got any concrete information on this, but I'm assuming that her linguistic skills would have been very useful in the interrogation of the German prisoners of war who were being repatriated, and her organisational skills in processing the thousands of British troops impatient to return home. Some of my historian friends insist that she must have been a spy, but I found nothing to substantiate this hypothesis. Back in London, Carrie took up the promised job offer from Mr. Baker. In contrast to her friend Maud Crofts, who had been prominent in the movement for the entry of women into the legal profession and had been one of the four women who'd taken the Law Society to court in 1913 in an unsuccessful attempt to obtain permission to study for and sit Law Society examinations. There is absolutely no evidence that Carrie had any early ambition at all to become a lawyer. However, her work at the Ministry of Munitions must have made her aware, if she had not been before, of the difficult lives led by many working class women. Indeed, it is a possibility that she may even have acted as an advocate for munitionettes and the tribunals, which were set up to address their grievances or to prosecute them for breach of regulations. While she was in Constantinople, the Sex Discrimination Removal Act 1919 had been passed, and she was now able to parlay Baker's job offer into a training contract with his firm. Remarkably, Baker did not ask for the usual large training premium paid by would-be solicitors to their training firms. Even more remarkably, he also paid her a small salary. He must have been very impressed. As late as the 1950s, it was customary for would-be solicitors to work for no salary, in addition to paying a premium for training that lasted 3 to 5 years. Thus, in general, only those who came from comfortably off families could afford to train as solicitors. Carrie began her training in 1920 when she came back from Constantinople, and after 2 years, and I'm really impressed by this, she performed the almost unprecedented feat of passing her intermediate and final examinations within 6 months of each other while working full-time for Kenneth Brown Baker Baker. Why was Baker willing to train her as a solicitor at an obvious financial cost to his firm? Well, not only was she intellectually able and an excellent linguist, both of which were attractive to him, but her left-leaning political beliefs were similar to his. During the 1920s and the 1930s, Baker's firm was investigated frequently by MI5 because of his representation of various luminaries of the Labour and Communist movements in Great Britain, including in 1920 Arthur McManus, who was the first chairman of the Communist Party of Great Britain. Later, Baker became a Labour councillor for Hackney, and just before his death in 1943, he was knighted for his services to the London County Council, of which he was elected chairman. So all sorts of things happen in people's lives. On qualification, Carrie intended that her legal career would be centred on common law litigation in the King's Bench, the knotty points in commercial cases, and crimes which come under the Children Act. Sadly, there's a gap between the optimism of this statement and being able to commence her legal career in earnest. Her sister and her mother died within months of each other in 1924. Her mother from natural causes, and her sister by committing suicide. The subsequent course of her life, both professional and personal, was to a large extent the result of her association with Toynbee Hall, a charitable institution set up by Augustus Barnett in Whitechapel in the East End of London, with the intention of providing education, entertainment, and legal services, mainly through the involvement of residents. Residents were young university-educated men who lived in very basic local accommodation owned by the charity. Women graduates were welcomed as non-resident volunteers who could join other lawyers in providing legal advice to the local inhabitants for free at a very discounted rate. Together, they were known as poor man's lawyers. So Carrie began her legal life as a volunteer at Toynbee Hall, and there she met Hector Munro, a good Scottish name, and Ambrose Appelby. Munro was already in partnership at 14 Mile End Road with Edith Berthon, the sixth woman to qualify as a solicitor in this country. Edith Berthon and Hector Munro returned to their native Liverpool in 1927. Their London firm, Berthon and Munro, was run for about a year by Carrie and Appelby before the two of them set up in partnership on their own account as Appelby and Morrison. But in 1929, another kind of partnership was reported in the press. Miss Carrie Morrison and Mr. A.E. Appelby were attended by 8 bridesmaids when they were married in truly up-to-date style by Maud Royden, a woman preacher. In fact, they had been married in a civil ceremony several days previously on 4th April at Stepney Register Office. Maud Royden was recognised as a preacher, but as she was a woman, she could not be ordained and therefore could not conduct a marriage ceremony. Carrie's new husband was 15 years younger than she was. This might have been considered unusual at the beginning of the war, but even more so when the war was over. Virginia Nicholson poignantly stated in her book, Singled Out, that the war had disposed of so many men that a whole cohort of young women had little or no hope of finding a husband, and often little hope of finding decently paid occupations either. During the war, government departments and other institutions had relied on educated young women of good family who could keep a secret to fill responsible positions vacated by the men now in active service, on the assumption that at the end of the war, they could be dismissed and go back to where they should, to the natural order of things, that men would work outside the home and women inside it. Cynical though this might appear, the government of the time, a conservative liberal coalition led by David Lloyd George, had to facilitate gainful employment for weary, angry men coming back from abroad and who had been trained and experienced extreme violence. Set against this background, why did a young man of 26 marry a woman of 41, when presumably he would have had the privilege of considerable choice? Sandy Alexander, one of Carrie's trainees, considered that Appelby was a go-getter who felt his career would be enhanced by being married to the first woman solicitor. However, we should not ignore a description of her character and competence published in the Folkestone, Hythe, Sandgate and Cheriton Herald of 10th October 1931, after Carrie became the first woman to speak at a Law Society conference. In case you may think from the foregoing that Miss Morrison is rather a fearsome blue stocking, I hasten to inform you she's quite human, kind, as I know very well, and feminine. I hasten to inform you, there were a good many who did not look with any great favour on the advent of women in the profession, especially when they preferred to specialise, as Miss Morrison did, in litigation rather than the more secluded branch of conveyancing. I don't know if there are any commercial law, commercial property solicitors here. You'd be interested to know it's a secluded branch. However, she has quite an active practice now in the East End of London. I know of no other lady solicitor who is more capable of speaking with authority on this branch of law, or of reading a paper to an assembly of her colleagues on courts of matrimonial relations, as she did this week. As partners, Carrie and Ambrose practiced from two main addresses. Carrie was based mainly in Whitechapel, while Appelby attempted to build up the partnership finances in their office in New Square, near the Royal Courts of Justice. The two partners shared very strong socialist and religious beliefs. Appelby was the son of a Methodist minister and was himself a Methodist lay officer. Carrie's background was more Church of England. But on one matter, they were definitely agreed. By the mid-1930s, both were committee members of the Ministry of Women, brackets, interdenominational brackets, an organisation working for the ordination of women. Appelby's political convictions were more radically and openly socialist than Carrie's. Carrie only came to MI5's notice because of her husband's involvement with the Haldane Society, the socialist lawyers group, and his at least tangential association with various members of the Communist Party of Great Britain. Well, life carried on like this for a while, but their marriage ended in 1937 when Carrie divorced her husband on the grounds of his adultery with a young journalist, Edith Marion Wilde. At that time, the divorce process was so highly adversarial that any suspicion that the two parties to the marriage had agreed the grounds for their divorce, especially by means of an arranged adultery, could lead a judge to refuse to grant it. Carrie and Appelby, fully aware of this, as their practice had acted in two reported cases where divorce was refused on the grounds of what was called collusion. The statement on Carrie's divorce petition that both she and Appelby were solicitors would have immediately alerted the judge to the possibility of collusion. Their status as solicitors laid them open to a double penalty if it could be shown either that Carrie had condoned Appelby's adultery by carrying on with the marriage, even though she knew of the adultery, or that they had both colluded in coming to some arrangement concerning the evidence of adultery before Carrie petitioned for the divorce. Discovery of any such condemnation or collusion would have led not only to the rejection of Carrie's petition, but the possible deprivation of their professional status and thus their livelihoods. So I wonder just what was the situation between them on this matter. The address on Carrie's petition was 1 C Holly Way, Jaywick, in Essex, a property which Carrie had purchased in her own name on the 21st of October 1935. She filed a divorce petition on 23rd July 1936, stating that from December 1935 until the date of the petition, Appelby had lived and cohabited and habitually committed adultery with Edith Marion Wilde at Frog's Crook, Riverside Avenue, Broxbourne. Frog's Crook was the marital home that Carrie had shared with Appelby. Moving from the marital home to her Jaywick property was a signal to the court that Carrie felt herself wronged, that she did not condone the relationship between Appleby and Miss Wilde, that their relationship was so abhorrent to her that she could no longer bear to live in the marital home that her husband had desecrated, and that there was no collusion. Otherwise, why would she, the wrong party, have been the one to move out? However, the dates of the property purchase and the presentation of the petition are suspiciously close. After the divorce, the two partners continued to practice together from their New Square offices. Maud Crofts, a Gartan friend and fellow solicitor, was horrified by this apparent forgiveness of Appleby's betrayal and expostulated, "Carrie, how could you?" Although Sandy Alexander told me that Appleby's propensity for going dancing without Carrie made her feel very sad, there was nothing in the divorce petition or the subsequent relationship of the parties concerned to suggest any great acrimony between them, and nothing to invite salacious comments in contemporary newspapers. Although there might have been such speculative reports from journalists, had they seen the contents of the will which Carrie republished the day after she received the decree absolute. At this point, she probably knew that Appleby intended to marry Miss Wilde only a month later. The will, in fact, named Appleby as her sole executor, and apart from some small legacies, as the sole beneficiary of her estate. During the 13 years between the divorce and her death, she saw no reason to change her will. If we now look at what she actually did in the legal circle, any commentary on or records of her legal work that I found suggest that it was concerned mainly with ameliorating the condition of those less fortunate. Sandy Alexander admired the way that she fought for those poor women in the East End, mainly prostitutes appearing before the magistrates. And in 1932, she was vociferous in the defence of the men accused of rioting against the eviction of a widow on the Beckentree estate, a model housing estate in Essex. In a wry comment during the trial, she effectively thanked the police for their restraint, commenting they were very sporty in not making much of their injuries. Both professionally and personally, the lives of both Carrie and Appleby were informed by a general belief that organisations, laws, customs, and even dress could be reformed and improved. Appleby was an advocate of rational dress. In a formal photograph of Toynbee Hall residence, he stands out as a young man in an open neck shirt where all the other men were in collar and tie. The photograph of Carrie, which used to be in the front hall of the Low Society, showed a woman to whom external appearance was not important. "I'm not sure that she knew what corsets and brassieres were," Sandy Alexander told me. Certainly looks like it. Appleby certainly, and possibly Carrie, was a member of a progressive league which advocated societal change and more personal freedom. At conferences, Carrie continued to advocate, sometimes with Appleby and sometimes by herself, substantial changes to the law and to legal and public institutions. Many of these changes have been made in the succeeding decades, even not until many years later. Despite a declaration when she qualified in 1922 that she did not want a practice based on family law, publicly she had a great deal to say on the subject. The 1931 paper she read at Folkestone, which I mentioned earlier, she argued for the institution of courts of domestic relations. These were friendly courts based on an American model, essentially to deal with matrimonial difficulties and family quarrels. She advocated the creation of a separate system of courts which would be less public and less intimidating for husband and wife alike, but which would have powers to dissolve a marriage, as well as being able to resolve disputes. This policy has gradually evolved over the succeeding decades, and of course may be about to change again if no-fault divorce is accepted. Carrie was also an active member of the Divorce Law Reform Union, which advocated reconciliation and accommodation rather than confrontation in divorce proceedings. Helena Normanton, who was vociferous in arguing for the reform of the law relating to divorce, commented that Carrie was the only woman lawyer who gave her any support in her efforts to change domestic legislation. The resultant Matrimonial Causes Act 1937, steered through Parliament by A.P. Herbert MP, provided additional grounds for divorce, including, to my surprise, incurable insanity. Had this legislation been in place in the previous century, the plot of Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre would have taken a different turn, I am sure. Both Carrie and Appleby were members of the Married Women's Association, which in 1943 supported the wife in the case of Blackwell and Blackwell. It's worth just reading through a very short summary of this case. Let me ask you a question. Mrs. Dorothy Blackwell had shopped at a cooperative society and had paid any money left over from the housekeeping allowance given to her by her husband into an account in her sole name with the cooperative society concerned. This sum increased over the years because of interest, dividends, or bonuses allowed by the society, but she didn't draw them out, she left the money in the account. When Mr. and Mrs. Blackwell later separated, Mr. Blackwell claimed that the total sum held by the society, which now amounted to £103.10, belonged to him. What do you think the court at first instance decided? Did he get it? Did she get it? Did they divide it?
I would think he got it.
He did, sadly. Yes. Anyway, to continue with the story, when Mrs. Blackwell then took her case to the Court of Appeal, supported by the Married Women's Association, Carrie acted as her solicitor. What do you think happened then?
They shared it. They shared it.
No.
She got it.
No. He got it again. Yes. When I read this case at first, I had a wonderful time wandering around the Law Society and asking anyone I met that I knew what they thought the outcome would be. And I'm glad to say that nobody said he got it. Just shows times have changed. And the court ruled firmly that a woman has no right to any savings. She makes some housekeeping. However, 20 years later, in 1964, the Married Women's Property Act established that housekeeping money belongs jointly to husband and wife. It would be wrong to assume that Carrie was motivated only by a desire to ameliorate the position of woman. Again and again, her statements on marriage, the family, and the position of woman demonstrate that she believed that society would be better organized if its laws were based on the twin concepts of justice being available to all and of fairness. Her view of fairness led her to fight for the rights of women like Mrs. Blackwell, which might benefit the majority of women. But as a member of the Interdenominational Society for the Ordination of Women, she worked for organizational change, which she knew in the short term would be likely to benefit only educated women, such as Maud Royden, the woman preacher who had married her. At the 1932 Law Society conference, it was suggested that English inheritance laws should be brought into line with Scotland. Always ahead of people, Scots, you see. so that a man could not disinherit his wife completely. Carey argued that if the legal profession were to support this change, it should apply equally to women, so that they could not disinherit husbands who survived them. And you may be surprised to hear that there were actually some female solicitors who argued against Carey. Carey could be scathing in her criticism of the behaviour of some working class woman whom she considered provoked their husbands into bad-tempered actions in order to obtain separation and maintenance orders from the courts. And at the 1939 Law Society provincial meeting, Carey had something else to say. Together with Appelby, they put forward a resolution that solicitors be obliged to contribute to a fund designed to compensate members of the public for the defalcations of errant solicitors. This was later established by the Solicitors Act 1941 as the Solicitors' Compensation Fund, to which each solicitor was obliged to pay £5 per annum in addition to their practising certificate fee. I'd like to say a little bit about her later life, after the divorce, because after the divorce she led a less nationally public life. She was, however, fully occupied. She was a Sir Optimist. She was Vice President of the 1919 Club, later the Association of Women Solicitors, and was active in her local church community. She used to catch the train from Broxburn to London in the morning to the New Square office and return in the evening to give free or low-cost advice in Broxburn. Appelby, on the other hand, was a very public fellow. He was an inventive and frequently reported eccentric. Briefly, the president of the Married Women's Association when Helena Normanton left. He was also founder of the Smell Society and was a founder member of the National Council for Civil Liberties, later Liberty. The firm that he and Carey founded in 1928 became Ambrose Appelby & Co. after her death, in which form it continued until 2014, when it merged with Bertram Dyson Bell. Carey died on the 20th of February 1950 in Broxbourne, in the house which she and Appelby had purchased together as husband and wife. Her body was discovered by two friends who'd come to take her to a Sunday morning church service. Just how much she was valued can be seen by the keeping of a minute's silence by both the 1919 Club and by her school's Old Girls Association. The Hertfordshire Mercury devoted a whole front page to her obituary. I've looked over several months of that newspaper to see whether this was usual. It was not. There were no other full-page obituaries of anyone, male or female. I'd like to end this with the words of her ex-husband, who summed up her character in a letter to Girton College after her death. He spoke of her integrity, frankness, and sincerity with sympathy to all who were suffering. That is an opinion with which I certainly would not disagree. Thank you.